Mindy Radio. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Hi-ya! KBOO is proud to co-sponsor a New Year's Eve Afrobeat and Salsa dance party with live performances from Palante and Jujuba in a benefit for Mercy Corps at the Red Rose Ballroom on Northeast Alberta and 19th on New Year's Eve, Tuesday, December 31st, from 9 p.m. till 1 a.m., and a salsa lesson at 8:30. Musical worlds converge when Nigerian Afrobeat band Jujuba and Afro-Cuban salsa and Latin band Palante bring the community out for this high-energy dance party to support the international relief work of Mercy Corps. The New Year's Eve celebration is at the Red Rose Ballroom on Northeast Alberta and 19th. For details, please go to kboo.fm and click on the New Year's Eve dance party link on the lower right side of the page.
Tune in at 6 p.m. Wednesday, December 25th, Christmas Day, for The Underground. Hosted by the KBOO Youth Collective, the show this month will feature stories and other works on the theme of magic. Learn about magician secrets, witches, Harry Potter, and more. That's Wednesday the 25th at 6 p.m. Christmas Day here on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Every day, the tar sands operations in northeastern Alberta produce 2 million barrels of oil, and within a few years, they are projected to double their production. But for tar sands oil production to remain profitable, all this heavy crude oil must make its way to markets that are far removed from these remote landlocked mining operations. The only means to move the oil is by pipelines, most of which have not yet been built, and oil trains. This morning, we'll talk about two proposed pipeline projects, which would carry tar sands delivered heavy crude to the Pacific Coast, as well as some of these oil trains that are proposed for the Northwest as well. These pipelines would need to cross British Columbia's remote mountainous wilderness, traversing some of the last remaining pristine salmon streams in North America and the lands of First Nations people. To talk about this, my guest is Matt Krogh, who's Tar Sands SOS Campaign Director for Forest Ethics in Bellingham, Washington. Matt, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, before we actually start talking about the pipelines, I just wanted to make a mention that the megaloads, which is the other part of the inputs to the tar sands as opposed to the outputs we're going to be talking about today, another megaload has left the Umatilla port, I understand, and is heading on its way through southeastern Oregon and across Idaho and up Montana to the tar sands. And there's going to be a protest today at Pendleton, I think at 5:30 this evening. People are gathering out there just to witness the megaloads and to, I guess, get a sense of how huge they are and how disruptive they are to the community, and also to make a statement that people are really opposed to them going through these very rural communities in southeastern, throughout eastern Oregon. So that's just kind of connected to what we're talking about today. Today we're going to be talking about the outputs that come from the tar sands. So first, Matt, I wanted to talk about why the pipelines are so critical to get this oil, which is being produced in massive amounts in northeastern Alberta, to markets.
Sure, you bet. I guess first, actually, to step back to the megaloads, the protest, and it actually is a protest today in Umatilla, it's really pretty heartening and reassuring to see folks actually working to stop the tar sands expansion at every level. Whether it's the inputs from these megaloads, which, you know, in their own right have a real impact on communities with giant, some of them 400 and 450 feet long loads coming through at very slow speeds and disrupting traffic and emergency response and all the rest of that. Seeing both community members, folks from groups like Rising Tide, or actually the very real leadership of the tribes, the First Nations, whether it's the Umatilla or the Nez Perce, have been very active in trying to protect their homelands from these pretty destructive practices. So I guess first I want to give a shout-out to the folks in eastern Oregon who are out there today, both witnessing and protesting the megaloads coming through.
And I'll just suggest that if you want to know more about getting out there, you don't have a whole lot of time, but people are leaving Portland at 1 o'clock. And if you go to Portland Rising Tide Facebook page, and just go to Facebook and then search for Portland Rising Tide, there'll be information about where to meet up. And if you have a car and you can shuttle other people out there, it'd be very much appreciated. And I wish I could be out there myself today. I unfortunately can't be, but I'm sure we'll be listening to reports. One other thing, if you want to get a sense of how huge this megaload is, there's amazing video footage that's on Portland Rising Tide's Facebook page from the first load going through the town of John Day last week. And there were two things that were very disconcerting about this video. One was you really get a sense of how big these loads are. I mean, they are beyond imagination. It's kind of like moving football fields. The other part of it is that people in John Day were lined up along Highway 26 cheering the loads as they went by. What do you think about that, Matt?
Well, you know, I'm not sure what folks in John Day would have to cheer for. I think one of the key features of this entire industry is that the outputs of the tar sands are, it's not for us. You know, the entire principle that we're about to talk about with the pipelines or the megaloads themselves is we see some economic benefit from manufacturing a few things, but you know, the particular megaload going through right now in Northeast Oregon came out of Japan. It just happens to be transshipping through our area, and the tar sands fuel is so dirty and so I guess unsavory that it, you know, we don't really want to use it in any high percentage in any of our refineries. So what we're talking about is you know, getting back to the pipelines, we're talking about a huge deposit of the dirtiest oil on the planet, the second largest oil deposit on the planet outside of Saudi Arabia, stranded in the middle of North America. Desperately, you know, or the oil itself is not desperate, but the companies are desperate to try to get that tar sands oil from the center of Alberta out any which way they can. And so the whole Keystone XL fight has been about trying to find a way to get just really a massive volume of the tar sands fuel down to the Gulf Coast, where we would use it some in U.S. refineries, but the reality is that you get to the end of the pipeline, they're going to sell it to whoever pays the highest price. So right now, the pressure that's out there of, you know, essentially we have a glut of oil coming out of North Dakota right now, that's the Bakken light oil, but deep, deep, deep down in Canada, we actually have this massive deposit, 30, 40 times larger than the Bakken deposit, that they're trying to get to world markets. And so the two pipelines that are proposed in BC right now, that's really what they're all about. It's an export game for Canadian companies and some U.S. companies to get Canadian tar sands oil out any which way they can.
Well, one of the things that's kind of interesting and perplexing is right now they are producing close to 1 million barrels per day of bitumen-derived oil up in Alberta. Their projection by 2035 is to be producing 5 million barrels per day. And they can't really, they could produce that, they probably can find a way to produce it, but the big question is, how can they get all that oil to market? I mean, because there is really no infrastructure at all right now that comes close to being able to bring out that much oil. So what is your sense, Matt, about how the connection between them being able to up their production and their ability to produce, to create the infrastructure?
Sure. Well, you know, we're seeing that exact same thing happen on the south side of the Canadian border right now as well in North Dakota, where what we've had is a massive run on new oil wells and new oil production capacity with no real way to get that oil to market. And so what's happened with in North Dakota is we've seen about 60-65% of that being shipped through pipeline, and the remainder, there's been this massive increase in oil by rail or crude by rail. And it's causing quite a bit of problem in terms of rail congestion. But, you know, they're planning to do more. And within the next several years, they're talking about getting 90% of the Bakken oil shale in North Dakota out by rail. Likewise, when you look at the pipeline fights that have been happening, the successful Keystone XL fight so far, the delay of the Enbridge or the Northern Gateway pipeline in B.C., or the second Kinder Morgan pipeline, which they just applied for permits a few days ago, all of these pipelines are designed to move 500,000 barrels a day, 580,000 barrels a day, in the case of Keystone, 870,000 barrels a day. Right now, they can only do about 400,000 barrels a day of onloading for tar sands crude to rail. Their plan, though, is to double that by next year and to keep increasing that amount. So when they talk about getting to 5 million barrels a day of production capacity, they are counting on the success either of multiple pipelines, and there's a couple more that are in the works that are supposed to head back east. They're counting on the success of pipeline construction, or they're imagining that they could have a real ramp up, a massive increase of crude, tar sands crude being transported by rail. And that's where we start to get into, you know, real direct impacts on all of us. And we're seeing some of that right now. The folks in North Dakota saw agricultural shipments delayed this summer because of rail congestion. And I just saw a news story a few days ago about Amtrak being delayed coming west from Chicago because of these crude trains, these unit trains. You know, they're up to 100 trains or 100 cars long of crude oil clogging the tracks. And there was a kind of a funny exchange, actually. The folks at Amtrak said, Hey, Burlington Northern, you know, your crude trains are clogging up our tracks. What are you going to do about it? And Burlington Northern's response was, it's cold. That was it. It was like, they didn't give an explanation of traffic. They didn't talk about what the actual cause was of the delays, why these Amtrak runs were canceled. All they said was, yeah, it's cold.
Meaning it's cold that it makes it harder to transport, or it's cold and we need the oil for heating?
I'm really not sure. This was a bit of a non sequitur, actually, and it's the sort of thing that I think we've come to expect from the railroads and not really disclosing what's going on. And, you know, maybe there was some weather impact to the tracks. Maybe there was a greater demand for some sort of heating oil. I don't know. But their lack of explanation was really notable.
Well, before we get into talking about the pipelines, let's talk a little bit more about the oil by train. How new a phenomenon is it to ship oil by train?
Well, you know, it's not new to ship oil by rail. It is new to do it in the incredible volumes that we have seen come about in the last couple of years, and also to do it by unit train. And so,
what's a unit train?
Sure, let me get to that a second.
Okay.
The first thing is about 7-8 years ago, we saw hundreds, 400, 500 carloads of oil, crude oil, being shipped by train. And those carloads would be part of another, they would call it a manifest train. So there's a bunch of other stuff, whether it's containers, tanks of other stuff, you know, whatever. You know, it's a train that's got all kinds of mixed freight in there. And some of that would be oil or crude oil. But now what we're seeing is over 400,000 carloads of oil every year. And those car loads are part of what we call unit trans, which means the train is never broken apart. It's all the same stuff, whether it's a bunch of coal cars, 100, 125 cars in that train, or a bunch of oil. That train goes from its source to its destination. It doesn't stop. It doesn't get broken apart and put into different trains and sent off in different pathways. It's all this one unit, and that's why they call it a unit train. And so when we talk about unit trains for crude oil, what we're also talking about is an incredible concentration of risk. You're talking about a bunch of stuff that tends to explode in the case of the Bakken crude from North Dakota, or would sink in an aquatic environment if you want to talk about tar sands. You're putting 100, 125 of these cars together, and you're talking about something that is a massive concentration of risk going right through our communities.
Well, this morning, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Matt Krogh, who's with Tar Sands SOS. He's a Tar Sands SOS campaign director for forest ethics. We're talking this morning about two pipelines in particular. We'll probably touch on a few, several more, that are proposed for piping tar sands bitumen diluted to so that it can actually flow through pipes from the tar sands in northeastern Alberta to the Pacific coast. And we're also talking right now about all these oil trains that are have proliferated, and I think we're going to get into the issue about some of these oil train terminals that are being proposed around Washington State. I think that people are familiar to some degree now with some of the dangers of the oil trains because of the really devastating fire that happened in Quebec last summer. And then there was another, I guess, less well-publicized fire in Alabama. So let's talk a little bit about these two fires and what they indicate about some of the potential dangers of shipping this much oil by train, and particularly the Bakken oil.
Sure. Well, you know, I think that's one of the things that we go back to the start of this conversation a few minutes ago. We talk about it's not for us. And this crude oil, whether it's the Bakken crude coming out of North Dakota or whether it's the tar sands crude coming out of Alberta, we're seeing all this risk associated with trains, potentially with pipelines, potentially with vessels. We'll get into both of those later. But the terminals that they're proposing, you'll note that most of them are not by refineries. Some of them are. But every one of those refineries and every one of those terminals can function as a, what you call it, a transshipment point, which means that the crude would come in by rail through all kinds of communities and get taken from their trains and put on boats, where it could go to, I don't know, refineries in California are hoping for some of this, but primarily into world markets. And so the American Petroleum Institute, which represents almost all of the oil companies in America, is currently lobbying both in Congress and at the World Trade Organization to overturn what is currently in place, and it's called a ban. It's not really a ban, it's just really difficult, but a ban on exporting American crude. And so you look at the economics behind all of this, and it's true that some of our refineries in California or Washington might want to process some of this crude, but the real game that's at hand is folks in Alberta or North Dakota and all the oil companies around the country really want to see crude coming through our communities on these trains, being transshipped, put on vessels, and sold into the world market where they get the highest price. So we're going to see all the risk of these trains coming through and realistically none of the reward. So when you talk about Bakken crude trains, when we talk about Alabama or what happened in Quebec and Lac Mégantic, you know that there's been a lack of understanding of exactly how explosive the oil coming out of North Dakota actually is. And it's been miscategorized, and it's been put in these old, fairly unsafe design cars that are currently under review by the Department of Transportation. But the fracking process itself appears to add a number of different very volatile components, whether it's carbon disulfide or hydrogen sulfide or other constituents that have a very low boiling point and tend to self-ignite. And putting these things that boil in cars that are not designed for pressure. And then, you know, you put them on in these unit trains and you run them up and down the tracks and you shake them. And you can imagine, you know, getting a hot can of Coke and shaking it, and eventually it's going to pop. And so what we saw in Lac Mégantic in Quebec this summer in July, the explosion that happened there was unexpected, unprecedented, where a train, essentially the operator left. There was one operator, and the emergency brakes apparently were not on, and the runaway train rolled into town. You would expect, you know, a fire from a crude train, but in this case, they got both the fire, and then the car started to explode. And that explosive component to it appears to come from the fracking process itself and is hugely dangerous. And, you know, those of us who looked at Lac Mégantic, of course, we were very worried about what happened there with the derailment and the fire and then the explosion. But it got more worrisome in November when in Alabama, in Aliceville, another train derailed, the same sort of stuff, Bakken crude, the fracked crude out of North Dakota. And there were explosions and there were fires, but it appears that that train actually exploded first and then derailed. And one of the concerns is it looks like the trains, as they're looking for all kinds of different routes, they're coming off the Class 1 rail, which is the, you know, best-maintained, smoothest rail. They're trying to find new routes. You know, the system's getting very clogged, so they're using Class 2 rail, like the rail that's going down through eastern Oregon, which is less well-maintained and bumpier. And there are very real concerns that as we get into hotter times of year and we run these trains down the bumpier tracks, the worst-maintained tracks, that we'll see yet more explosions.
Well, actually, it makes me think about the route of the megaloads again. This morning, before I came to the station, I was looking at a map of eastern Oregon trying to figure out the route that those that truck is taking, because it's really going very far out of its way to avoid Highway 12 in Idaho, which it can't go on right now because of an injunction. So it's going on these really back roads in southeastern Oregon and through the very southern part of Idaho. Again, not that well-maintained road. So it makes me think that this boom that we're experiencing in oil and gas production is making us, we're relying on very bizarre Byzantine ways of getting it to market. And I wonder if this is an indication of how unprepared we are in a lot of ways for the next step, what happens after you actually get the oil, you get it out of the ground. We don't seem to have a way to get it in any kind of reasonable way to market.
You know, I think that's true. And one of my buddies, Eric DePlace, who works at Sightline Institute up in Seattle, he and I have been talking about this issue in a variety of different ways. And I've been kind of focused on the size of the carbon deposits, you know, whether or not it's a 3.5 billion short tons of recoverable carbon in the Bakken, or for that matter, you know, 25 billion in the Powder River Basin for coal. We get nearly 100 billion short tons of recoverable carbon in Alberta for the tar sands. But what Eric's been focused on is the size of the pipes that, you know, that we're trying to squeeze this stuff through. Like, how many trains can go down a set of tracks? How many barrels of oil does that translate to? Or how big are these terminals? For example, the one in proposed for Vancouver, Washington, is a 360,000 barrel a day terminal, which is more than we use in the state of Washington, or roughly what we use. And, you know, when you talk about the enormous pressure that these, you know, these deposits are there, the companies that want to develop them, they want to put all this stuff on the market as fast as they can, there's this giant pressure. It's like a, you know, you squeeze a balloon that has a pinhole here and a pinhole there and a pinhole there and all this water squirting out. I think that's the same thing that we see for these tracks, whether you're talking about Class 2 rail or Class 1 rail or the overburdened pipelines, the older pipelines and the new ones they want to, you know, all these different things, these little pinholes that are accessing these deposits, and, you know, it's spraying out everywhere. And I think we're going to see that the more throughput we get, the more risk we get. And I can't even imagine what it's going to look like around America this year in the summer if indeed they expand the production of Bakken crude the way they're planning to, and if they are able to use these desperately unsafe rail cars that they've been using for years and throw them all out there on some Class 2 rail and shake them around during the summer, I think we're going to see a lot more tragedy like we've seen this last year.
Well, when I was talking with you and Eric a couple weeks ago, you were mentioning a strange alliance between environmentalists who are opposing the oil trains and the railroad industry, that they have joined forces together against the oil industry. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think alliance is a bit of an overstatement. The Association of American Railroads, which represents most of the American railroads, much like the American Petroleum Institute represents most of the oil companies, the AAR filed comments as part of a public comment period. And so the Department of Transportation has a sub-agency, the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, which regulates the types of cars that are allowed to transport various toxic or explosive substances. And that includes the ones that are used for crude oil, both for tar sands and for the Bakken oil. And so they had a proposed rule, you know, a set of regulations for these rail cars. And we, you know, over 100,000 people commented on a proposed rule. We weren't even at the final rulemaking, which will come out in spring, I think. But this proposed rulemaking, 100,000 people commented, and the Association of American Railroads. And we were really shocked, actually. You know, we submitted our own comments, and a whole bunch of people signed on saying, you know, we need to get these unsafe cars off the rail. They're prone to puncturing on derailing, and they're prone to exploding. They don't do anything for the pressurized contents of something like Bakken crude in it. And you know, we've known, or the National Transportation Safety Board has known at least since the early 1990s that these cars are unsafe, but they don't have any actual authority. And so the DOT really hasn't done anything to improve these cars. But right now we have this chance. And so environmentalists, the public broadly, people who are concerned about public safety, a whole bunch of folks filed comments and said, we need to get these off the rail. They're dangerous. They're a problem. And then we were shocked to find that the Association of American Railroads, when they filed their comments, said they're unsafe. they're dangerous. We've got to get them off the rail. And so we're going to explore that a little bit more to see what it really means. But my guess is that the AAR does not necessarily need to get them off the rails immediately, whereas those of us who are deeply concerned about community safety would love to see these unsafe rail cars banned immediately, and if they need to be replaced with something much, much safer.
Well, I do find that there's sometimes these kind of unusual allied interests, in this case, the Association of Railroads and environmentalists and public safety people. It reminds me of a story that Eric was telling me about, one of the big reasons why the Kinder Morgan coal terminal got axed in Rainier, or St. Helens in that area, was because PGE stepped in and said, we don't want this here. It's going to jeopardize our gas plant that we have. And they know Kinder Morgan quite well, having Kinder Morgan being once Enron, or the residue of Enron, and PGE once being owned by Enron. And they knew that Kinder Morgan had a very horrible history with coal storage. So it's interesting where we find that there are these places where we might find allies in unusual places. Do you think that there's a possibility that the fact that the railroads and you guys have very similar comments about the safety of these cars might make a forceful alliance in the future?
You know, I think there's a possibility that in terms of actually getting these dangerous cars out the rail, that we could be working together in 4 or 6 months, whenever the final public comment period comes forward, but should be about 90 days. I'm hopeful. I think it'll be late spring, early summer. The sooner the better. We would love to have a chance to actually improve safety standards. But the reality is that the railroads want to see as much shipment as they can. They want to profit from it. The oil companies, of course, and the third party companies who own these cars most of the time. Of course, they want to see these cars stay on the rail. So there's going to be a heck of a fight. The reality is the railroads are exposed to a lot of liability because of stuff truly is that dangerous. And if you look at North America and you think about the deposits in North Dakota or the deposits in Alberta and these terminals, and there's 34 new terminals around the U.S. proposed, 15 or so on the West Coast, 5 on the Gulf Coast, the rest on the East Coast. There's, you know, anybody who lives in a terminal community has heard about this. They know that trains might be coming. Anybody who lives in or near the mines or the wells, they know what's going on. But there's the tens of millions of people and the thousands of miles of track in between that center of North America and these coastal terminals that are proposed where nobody's been notified. And that's one of the things that we're going to be working on between now and whenever this next public comment period actually opens, which is to let people know that they have a voice in this, that they can influence the standards, that they can make sure that these most dangerous of the cars aren't coming through loaded with Bakken crude or with tar sands crude. And it's a real opportunity, actually. We do have a wonderful system in place where we get the opportunity to comment, and I'm going to encourage everybody and hopefully all your listeners when the time comes around to actually take part in that process.
Well, when I was on my way up to Seattle to meet with you and Eric a couple of weeks ago, I actually saw one of those trains somewhere. It was right around Centralia.
Mm-hmm.
So I want you to describe what those trains look like. And also, was it just a coincidence that I saw the train on my way to talk to you about the trains? Or is this a very common experience people would have if they just look to the right as they're driving up I-5?
Well, you know, right or left, it depends on where you are. But, you know, it's an increasingly common experience, and it's an experience that we remain unprepared for. The Department of Ecology here in the state of Washington has admitted that they really don't have any plan to clean up tar sands crude. And the first responders, you know, if you indeed have a derailment or a fire with the Bakken crude, I asked one of my friends who is a first responder up at the refineries in North Whatcom County in the northwest corner of Washington State, you know, what do you do if these cars are on fire? And he says, well, we don't do anything. We just evacuate. And you know, up in Alberta, they had another derailment in late October, and they waited for 4 days until everything had either exploded or burned, because the first responders can't go anywhere near this stuff. It's just too dangerous when it actually explodes. And so here in Washington, you know, we've seen a huge ramp up over the last 3 years from essentially none of those trains that you're talking about. And then again, what you saw was a unit train. It's all the same cars. They're all black, color of the oil, or perhaps of the Empire, if you want to go Star Wars. And they started coming. Oh boy, the big ones about 2 years ago, up to the Tesoro refinery up in March Point, which is near Anacortes. Again, in northwest Washington, and we've seen an increasing number of them coming through. And one of the real concerns is that we'll see more and more of these unit trains of oil sharing the tracks with unit trains of coal. And I don't know if you reported on it on your show or not, but a group of waterkeepers in Washington actually sued Burlington Northern earlier this summer for the discharge of coal dust to the tracks. And that discharge of coal dust, one of the real concerns about it is that it can increase the likelihood of derailments. They say it fouls the ballast, it fills it up so that it can't actually drain appropriately, the ballast being all that rock between the ties. And when it can't drain, you get the track shifting, and you get uneven tracks, and you get derailments. So the real concern here is that we see a bunch of coal trains coming through, fouling the ballast, making the tracks rougher, and then seeing the oil trains coming along behind them and derailing.
Well, that brings us to an interesting connection, I guess, between the three issues that we've been dealing with here in the Northwest, the coal trains, the oil trains, and the pipelines. And how does this show to you that we need to look a little bit more at the interconnections between these different issues? Some people are fighting the coal trains, other people are fighting the oil trains, other people are fighting pipelines. How are they all connected, basically?
Well, you know, it comes back to this, and it's become sort of a mantra for me, which is it's really not for us. All these plays that the fossil fuel companies are putting in place or trying to put in place are for export, and they're getting the hydrocarbon energy sources from North America out to world markets. And so, you know, the coal, you know, I've worked for years trying to fight the coal terminal up here in Bellingham, Washington, the Gateway Pacific, proposed Gateway Pacific Terminal. You know, that the coal is for energy elsewhere. We've done an incredible, or electricity elsewhere, we've done an incredible job in the U.S. West Coast and the Northwest in particular of finding alternatives, of actually implementing alternatives for our electricity. We have one remaining functioning coal-fired power plant in Washington, which is being phased out. We do get, or Puget Sound Energy gets a good bit of its energy from the Colstrip power plant in Montana, which we're trying to phase out. But we have real solutions for electricity. Likewise, we have real solutions for oil. One of the reasons why these oil companies are so desperate to export is because we're seeing a decline in demand in the U.S. for oil. We have transit solutions. We have better built communities. We have the ability to walk and bike. We have electric cars are on the uprise. We have all these different ways to get around without liquid transportation fuels. And so what we see are the companies that are, you know, dependent on growth, not growing. They see the demand for coal diving. They see the demand for oil declining in the U.S., and they're desperate to find ways to export their product because otherwise they're going to die as an industry or as companies. And so what we have that overlaps, whether it's a pipeline, whether it's coal, whether it's oil, it's those of us who are here living on the West Coast, living in America, you know, doing the best we can to move forward, recognizing the impacts of fossil fuels, the climate change impacts, the community health impacts. We're doing something about it. But now, because of the success that we're having, now we have to fight these companies that are thrashing around in sort of their death throes, desperately trying to find ways to get their hydrocarbons to market.
So why are so many of these terminals being proposed for the Pacific Northwest?
Well, when you look around at the actual costs of rail and what it takes to get oil from the center of the continent out, you're looking at $14 or $15 to get a barrel of crude from, well, we'll start with North Dakota. It's roughly true for anything coming out of Alberta as well. $14 or $15 to get it to the East Coast. You're talking about around $14 or $13 to get it to the Gulf Coast, $13 or so to LA and San Francisco, and less than $10 to get it to Puget Sound. So that's the cost of moving a barrel of oil from North Dakota to any of these particular ports. And so when you think about where the market demand is coming from for this oil, you know, right now the refineries around the Pacific Rim aren't tooled up yet to get that much tar sands oil in. But if they actually had a robust supply, whether it's from a rail terminal or a series of rail terminals or a pipeline, they could easily convert over the course of a year or so to accept everything that could possibly come out of the Alberta tar sands. So these, you know, the ones on the West Coast are by far the closest to the probable markets in Asia. They're by far the cheapest to get to. You know, the Gulf will work too, especially with the expansion of the Panama Canal. You're talking about essentially a bulk commodity. And having bigger ships being able to go through the expanded Panama Canal makes that a little bit more feasible, but it's still more expensive than going to the West Coast.
Well, I want to move on to the pipelines and let listeners know if you're listening to KBOO, and this is Locus Focus, and this morning we're talking with Matt Krogh, who's the Tar Sands SOS Campaign Director for Forest Ethics in Bellingham. And we've been talking about the oil trains. Now we're going to talk about the pipelines that are being proposed to go across British Columbia to carry tar sands crude to probably markets in Asia. Is that correct, Matt?
Yeah. I mean, that's, again, I think we do see some market on the west coast of the U.S., and right now there is an existing pipeline that goes to, operated by Kinder Morgan, that goes to Vancouver, British Columbia, and that pipeline has up to 300,000 barrels a day capacity. It's not all tar sands coming through. It's mostly tar sands. Some of that goes to the refineries in Washington right now. I think we're getting about 35 or 40,000 barrels a day of tar sands oil going to Washington State refineries. Some of it's going to a refinery there in Vancouver, but the rest is getting loaded onto ships. Right now we're at about 100 a year, and they are mostly going down to California to be processed both in the San Francisco and Los Angeles region refineries. So the pipeline that's there right now has a small trickle that's coming to the U.S. West Coast, but I think we're getting pretty close to using as much as we can. And so these two new pipelines that they're talking about are really solely for export. The one that would be next to the current, well, close to the current Kinder Morgan pipeline would be up to about 580,000 barrels a day. So you're talking about three-quarters of Keystone. And that would be coming directly to Vancouver, British Columbia, and all of that would be shipped. So we'd be talking about going from 80 or 100 ships per year right now to over 400 going through all the very, very sensitive waterways of Puget Sound and out into the Pacific. And then the second pipeline is called the Northern Gateway, and it would go to a place called Kitimat up in the central BC coast. And that is proposed to be 525,000 barrels a day. And unlike the one that would go to Vancouver if they get to build it, that would be able to receive super tankers. And you're talking about the biggest ships on the seas. Filled with tar sands crude, navigating an incredibly treacherous and narrow waterway in order just to even be able to access the Pacific Ocean, where you have some of the largest storms and biggest waves out there. So it's actually kind of funny, the company Enbridge, which has proposed the Northern Gateway, which just was actually conditionally approved last week with 209 conditions by Canada's National Energy Board, the company is so sensitive to concerns about the dangers of the shipping channel, which is incredibly dangerous, that they put out a promotional video to show people how wonderful this process is. And they show, you know, the beautiful pipeline running through pristine forests, not spilling anything, loading onto ships, and then this ship goes out this big, wide, open channel onto the beautiful, placid Pacific Ocean in this one straight line. And, you know, they've, in this animation, they've removed every island, every rock, every twist, every you know, it's this fantasy. That maybe it's actually what they think is going to happen. But
well, this is the company that said that bitumen doesn't spill.
That's right. It doesn't spill.
They live in an alternate reality somewhere.
Yeah, you know, it seems like that's the case. And the problem is that there's a lot of collusion as well between government agencies and these companies, and just also last week, all these things are happening all at the same time. Kinder Morgan filed for their permit to build the second pipeline to Vancouver. Enbridge got their conditional approval for the Northern Gateway, and Canada released their oil spill response plan, which didn't talk about what happens with a bitumen spill or a diluted bitumen or tar sands, whatever you want to call it. They have no plan for the stuff which sinks.
Let's talk a bit more about, I think we need to back up a little bit and talk about what bitumen is and what dilbit is. I was at a meeting, one of the planning meetings for the megaloids a couple of weeks ago, and I found that even people from Portland Rising Tide really don't have a handle on what bitumen is. So let's describe that and sort of the steps it takes to go from being tar sands in the ground to being something that goes through pipes and winds up at some tanker port.
Sure. So there's this, I think we all have in our mind this idea that oil comes out of the ground in giant gushers when you tap it, and it's a big flowing blackish liquid and whatnot. But bitumen is actually sort of between the crude oil, and you could even call it, you know, getting closer to crushed coal if you wanted to. But it's gooey, it's asphalty, it's a mix of clay and water and sand and the hydrocarbon itself. And in order to, you know, get out of the ground, they actually use a number of different techniques. It includes steam injection or various kinds of fracking, or scraping it up and moving it to the central refinery areas where they mix it up, and they try to pull out as much of the clay and the oil and the water as they can. But then they mix it with what's called diluent, which is usually condensate of natural gas. And, you know, stuff that's really high in carcinogens, but they're mixing it up to about 15 or 20% in order to make it thin enough that it can actually flow through a pipe. Or they might not thin it quite as much and be able to load it into rail cars. And so what we're talking about is a asphalty goo that's been thinned with, you can think of it as like paint thinner if you want, so that it can actually flow some or get pushed through a pipeline. And when it spills into an aquatic environment, what we see is, first off, the diluent itself is thinner and it evaporates, and then the solid stuff sinks. And what we saw in 2010 was a spill of nearly 1 million gallons of tar sands from the Enbridge pipeline in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And, you know, that happened over a period of time. And that million gallons of tar sands crude ended up coating about 35 miles of river bottom of the Kalamazoo River. And that river bottom, 3 years later, is still dead. People are finding chunks, essentially, of tar sands that have rolled up into balls and brought along dirt with them. And, you know, we're continuing to see both human health and environmental health impacts from that tar sand spill 3 years later and after hundreds of millions of dollars that were spent to clean it up.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're describing what happens when this stuff spills, and I'm thinking about an interview I did with one of the oil representatives in Canada a couple months ago, and he was talking about once they get the they combine the bitumen and the diluent, then it's mixed up and it stays together.
And yeah, that's not true.
Yeah, and this guy said that the equipment that they are using for the steam assisted gravity drainage method, which is digging deep down thousands of feet to get the bitumen up, that the equipment they're using is very small compared to the open pit mines, which are, I guess, the size of Seattle. But having looked at the video of the module that's going up right now to be part of that SAGD operation, I would beg to differ with him. I don't think it's very small. So, but it is interesting that they have all these answers when you interview them as the press, and they come up with all these answers to concerns that are raised, but they seem to have very little to do with the actual reality or the actual science.
Yeah, you know, it's actually pretty stunning how much the, I don't know, maybe the guys who are saying that stuff to you, maybe they believe it, but it's not true. And having, you know, the first world or firsthand experience of what happened in Arkansas and Mayflower, Arkansas, and the tar sand spill there that wiped out an entire neighborhood, seeing what happens with the contamination of watersheds by oil, seeing, I was just reviewing the spill response plan for the pipeline, the spur that currently comes to Washington. So the Kinder Morgan pipeline that goes to Vancouver, the way that oil gets to the Puget Sound refineries is by a small pipeline called the Puget Sound Pipeline. It's a little over 100,000 barrels a day. And we had a public comment period for that. Again, it's a little geeky, but it's the sort of thing that you can get involved in. And when you see what's happening, it's kind of shocking, which is, you know, about a third maybe of what goes to that pipeline is tar sands. And it's this oil that some of it is the same stuff that spilled in Kalamazoo. We know it sinks. You know, it comes out, some of it evaporates, and the heavy stuff sinks and ends up, you know, distributed along the benthic regions or the bottom regions of a aquatic habitat. But the spill response plan that the pipeline operators put together plans to use booms and skimmers. They just assume it's going to float. They miscategorized it in the various kinds of categories for crude oil, and they provide a response plan that skims it off the top, and they do nothing that acknowledges that it actually sinks. And so there's, I don't know if it's denial, I don't know if it's deception, I don't know if they're not paying attention, but none of those are really comfortable answers when you're actually being asked to trust the oil companies to protect us from a spill, or if there is a spill, to be able to clean it up and to find that they don't actually have a plan that can work. If, or I should probably say when, because all these things tend to rupture over time. It's deeply disconcerting.
Well, one of the things we haven't really discussed yet is just exactly the terrain that the Northern Gateway Pipeline would traverse and some of the difficulties that it's encountering. Maybe it's gotten a conditional approval by the federal Canadian government, but it's having some issues getting across British Columbia. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, so I work for a group called Forest Ethics, and we've been around for about 20 years. But one of the reasons this group was originally founded was to try to protect these incredible virgin forests in central BC, British Columbia, and also on Vancouver Island itself, which is, you know, some 300-400 miles long. It's an incredible and beautiful place. Part of what's happening with the route for the Northern Gateway is it goes through just stunning and amazing wilderness, some of the last really untouched forests on the planet. Part of it goes near the Great Bear Rainforest, which is something that we are working very, very hard to protect. And we're talking about incredibly productive salmon streams and rivers and old growth and a whole lot of folks who have lived there for thousands of years, the First Nations of Canada, who really don't want this pipeline coming through. And one of the most amazing untold stories on this side of the border is the fight against Enbridge, the Northern Gateway Pipeline, which is sponsored by the company Enbridge, has seen incredible leadership by the First Nations of Canada. And they have created what's essentially an unbroken wall of resistance. There's no route this pipeline can go where one or another of the First Nations has not actively opposed it or blockaded or fought this pipeline. And in 2012, the number one story and the media in British Columbia was the Enbridge pipeline. No elections, not the U.S. elections, not world events, but the Enbridge pipeline. And yet, here on the south side of the Canadian border, we really rarely hear about this fight. We rarely hear about the incredible courage and leadership of the First Nations in fighting this thing that is such a threat to, you know, millennia of their way of life. And we also don't hear about the direct threats to us from these tar sands tankers that come down through. Up here, you know, we go through two different straits around the San Juan Islands and out the Strait of Juan de Fuca, but then all these tar sands tankers are exposed to the weather of the Pacific coast. You know, you get down near the mouth of the Columbia and you have the graveyard of the Pacific, all the way down along the Oregon coast to San Francisco or L.A., and these are huge, huge tankers with an incredible amount of risk that, you know, they're fighting it in British Columbia, the expansion thereof, and it's a fight that we... You know, rising tide, some other folks have been engaged down on the south side, but it's so quiet on the south side of the border compared to what's happening on the north side.
Well, actually, I had the same experience several years ago when I started learning about tar sands and started following it and trying to cover it. And I would Google it and find incredible information coming from Canada and realize that there's this massive anti-tar sands movement in Canada. And this is before Keystone XL brought the term tar sands to the American consciousness. And I thought, this is really a sleeping giant here. I mean, nobody understands that we're already getting gasoline. As you've described, I mean, if listeners probably have figured out that there's a certain percentage of the gas coming into our tanks that's coming from the tar sands, since we here in Portland, we get our gas from Anacortes. So I think that it's really important that we ignite this battle. And I think that a place to really look at for us here is this Kinder Morgan proposed twinning, as I say, of the existing pipeline that goes to Burnaby from Edmonton. And how is that going to affect us here in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, so those pipelines are coming to BC. I mean, you have two key impacts for the Northwest. The first, of course, would be a massive increase in vessel traffic. And you're talking about not just real oil spill risk of a type of oil that we don't know how to deal with during a spill, but you're talking about sound as well. And the sound directly impacts orcas, it directly impacts marine mammals, impacts fish habit, fish behavior. And you're talking about direct risk to those ecosystems. But the second thing is that when it's processed in refineries, you have a much higher output of various kinds of contaminants, whether it's sulfur or you're talking about whatever is done, and it depends on the refinery, depends on the type of terminal, what's done with diluent itself, which has a lot of toluene, benzene, other carcinogens. And the reality is that these pipelines will have real impact both on putting much dirtier fuel into refineries and the massive increase in oil spill risk. But when you talk about Vancouver, Washington, or when you talk about Portland, the real concern there is bringing in tar sands by rail. Of course, the exposure to oil spill risk all along the Columbia, because this rail route comes right next to the Columbia for hundreds of miles. But you're also trying to deal with this stuff that is diluted with again, with a condensate that has natural gas components to it and carcinogenic components to it. The proposal for Vancouver is planning to burn it.
Let's get a little bit back. So the condensate is used to dilute the
bitumen.
The bitumen. So yeah. Then when they're, why do they have to burn the condensate when the trains arrive in Vancouver?
So what's happening is they want to pull the tar sands out of the rail and they want to put it in a ship. And the people who are buying it aren't buying diluent, they're buying the bitumen itself. So they want to remove this diluent before they ship it, which can be about 15%, 20% of the total volume. And so some of the proposals plan to recover that diluent and ship it back. The particular proposal for Vancouver, the euphemism they use is thermal oxidation, which most of us call burning or flaring. And we did a rough calculation at, you know, if it's 99% successful, the burning of this diluent, and they're bringing through about 120,000 barrels a day, which is about a third of the capacity for Vancouver, and they're proposing it looks like about that much to be tar sands. We're talking about 80,000 or 75,000 pounds of toxics going unburned into the air in Vancouver, you know, just a few miles downwind or upwind from Portland.
Well, I've talked to tar sands proponents in Canada. They argue that, they say that the people who are opposing the pipelines and opposing the oil trains are really opposing oil. They're anti-oil. They want to shut down the tar sands because they want us to get off oil, and that's not realistic. So what would you say to that?
Gosh, well, I would hope that given the reality of what's happening in the climate that we're all hoping to get off oil eventually, right now that we can't replace oil immediately, but we can, within a generation, get off of oil and find ways to actually transport ourselves without it. And so, you know, the expansion of the tar sands is a threat to the people who have lived there for thousands of years. There are rare cancers. It's a threat to the boreal forest, which is an incredible carbon sink that helps us with climate change. And the reality is that, you know, when you talk about 100 billion short tons of carbon waiting to come out, it's something we've got to stop. You know, we look at the numbers. We can use about half of the oil that we have left. And maybe have a chance of staying within some of our parameters for climate change concerns. But the bottom half of the barrel, we can't touch it. And this this stuff in Alberta is the bottom of the barrel. And when it comes to carbon intensity, carbon consumption, and the impacts on the environment. So I would hope that we're all working to get beyond oil sooner rather than later. But in terms of this, the tar sands, they're a huge problem. They're incredibly toxic, and they are much, much higher carbon intensity for the same gallon of gas as more conventional fuel.
Well, one last thing. You mentioned the unbroken wall of resistance up in Canada. I'm wondering if you have a sense of how the tribes in the United States can look towards the tribes in Canada as to see examples of what they can do. I know that the British Columbia tribes have a lot more control over their land than tribes do south of the border. But what kind of modeling do you see is going on in Canada that can be inspiration for people who are trying to stop the mega loads and the oil trains and the pipelines south of the border?
Well, honestly, I've been just as inspired by the tribes on the south side of the border. It just hasn't become as big an issue yet. The Columbia River Intertribal Fishing Commission has been active in opposing the coal trains and also on record for oil. The Lummi tribe here in Bellingham, Washington, and the Nooksack tribe and the Swinomish have all been very active in opposing the giant coal carriers, and we expect to see them engaged on this issue as well. The Umatilla, of course, are out in force today, and the Nez Perce last month we saw their leadership. I think a dozen of them or so got arrested opposing a megaload coming through. And so it's true that the some of the First Nations up in Canada never signed treaties. They never gave away land and have all the rights that comes with that. But what we have here on the south side are incredible examples of leadership, people who have been here for thousands of years and taking care of the place, and they appear to be stepping up and stepping up yet more to continue to take care of it.
Well, it's been really great talking with you, Matt, and I'd like to stay in touch and maybe have you come back on in a few months and do an update, particularly about what's happening with the Northern Gateway and the Trans Mountain pipelines and how they relate to us down here.
I'm looking forward to it, and we just have this conditional approval for the Northern Gateway pipeline, and as we start digging through that permit, we'll really see what it looks like and what the shape of the fight's going to look like.
So maybe we can talk again in February or March. So we'll check in then.
That sounds great.
Okay, thanks a whole lot. We've been talking with Matt Krogh, who's Tar Sands SOS Campaign Director for Forest Ethics in Bellingham, Washington, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we're going to be rebroadcasting an interview I did with Richard Heinberg, author of Snake Oil. I'll be back live in 2 weeks with Andrew Nikiforuk talking more about tar sands related issues, particularly about that condensate that Matt was talking about, the diluent in the bitumen that's being shipped by pipe. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the band Mystery Train. Thanks for listening.
Paul Butterfield.
And it is 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland. And coming up next is Disability Awareness with host Grace Reed. She will be interviewing Laura Sandow, a veteran with a disability, and they'll talk about hidden disabilities. And stay tuned at 11:30 for Health and Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall.
What we're going to do is throw a lot of banana peels around Chicago and have the machine stumble.
I had a dream that the only reason the employers were so powerful was that we were weak.
There's this myth that black people did not resist until Watts or until the Black Panther Party. It's just not true.
Tune In, Turn On, and Remember is a monthly special program on the history of KBOO Community Radio, commemorating KBOO's 45th anniversary year. The last installment of this special series will be on December 24th at 6 p.m. And listen online to the full series at kboo.fm/tunein/turnon.
KBOO is seeking a station manager to lead our dynamic 45-year-old non-commercial radio station. Ideal candidates will have nonprofit management experience, the ability to thrive and work collaboratively in a decentralized organization, and the ability to delegate, plan, and organize people to meet goals and objectives. If this interests you, please go to kboo.fm/stationmanagerhire2013.
Welcome to Disability Awareness. I'm your host, Grace Eagle Reed, and my guest today is Laura Sandow. Laura, introduce yourself. Tell us who you are and what you're doing. And today's subject matter is invisible disabilities. But first, let's hear who Laura is and what she's up to.
Hi, I'm Laura. I am a student at Portland State currently, studying social art practices. I am a disabled veteran, and I feel that addressing invisible